dog is gonna have the news.
Can you hear yourself? Okay?
Yeah, I might be loud actually. I don't know. I went to Jay's and had an old fashioned, so it might be louder than usual.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. It's the LA podcast. Scott Frazier.
Hayes Davenport.
I'm so excited. I've been all week. I wake up.
Yeah.
Ever since this gondola thing started, I've woken up being like, I cannot wait.
With a big smile on your face.
To talk about this. But then I remember it's like, oh, we're not recording until late, you know, I've had to wait and wait and wait.
Shuffling your feet like, oh man.
Yes, just like moping around the house. My wife is like, what's the matter? Oh, I don't get to. And then I'll like try to talk to her about it for hours. She is definitely not as excited as I am. I am so excited. Not about the gondola itself necessarily, but just to talk about it. So this is what, should we just say basically what happened? Earlier this week,
right,
the mayor does a press release.
Saying basically, we have an unsolicited proposal to service Dodger Stadium by means of a gondola.
Yes.
Aerial tramway, kind of like, you know, what's in San Diego Park, Wild Animal Park, or Disneyland.
Oh, that's an interesting comparison. It's like basically so you can look at the wild animals below.
Yeah, the common folk on Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah. And he's like, it's a private investor who's putting up the money for this. Another private investor who, right, instead of wanting to dig a tunnel under the ground to get around LA, is now going through the air. Anything but riding a bus.
So you can immediately rule out Elon Musk. He hates things that go in the air. He only likes underground.
So then the next day, they do this announcement of the gondola program, and they announce the identity of the secret private investor, who is Drew McCourt, son of Frank McCourt, baby. Frank is back.
Yeah, you thought you got rid of Frank McCourt, Jamie McCourt, and all of his kids. You were wrong.
Yes. This is so incredible to me that we are getting back in business with the McCourts as a city after what happened with the Dodgers, especially for something that involves like human bodies suspended like 100 feet in the air. Like, if this gondola ended up as the equivalent disaster of the McCourt ownership of the Dodgers, it will mean unprecedented death in the public works.
Bodies raining from the sky.
I have a personal connection to the McCourts, which is why I'm anxious to talk about it. Finally, I can shoehorn myself into one of these stories. He's from Boston, right, which is where I grew up outside of Boston. And I went to high school with his sons, Drew and Travis. Travis is the older son, I think.
Did they always have an interest in aerial tramways?
In gondolas? Yeah, they took a gondola to school.
Oh, of course.
Every day. Travis was kind of the alpha, is my only real memory of them. Drew was a little smaller.
This makes sense to me because he's the one who's not involved in the proposal.
Yes, that Travis is not. Right. Yeah. And Drew, I think, to finally get his father's love over Travis, is choosing gondolas as a way to achieve that. The McCourts are so fascinating to me because he was just a guy who owned a parking lot in Boston. Like
a single parking lot.
Yeah. Okay. Like he bought, so his dad was in construction. His grandfather was a real estate guy. He was part owner of the Boston Braves, who eventually moved to Atlanta. And so Frank McCourt is the scion of a couple generations of real estate construction family, but he wants a lot more publicity.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, it echoes something in our current political landscape. I saw a quote I found from him in some magazine where he said, "I knew from very early on that I wanted to build things. I learned that at the knee of my dad. I used to love going to work with him and having him put me on a bulldozer or front end loader." If I told you that the president said that, who, of course, I mean, he has said that. This is the same person. My only memory of him, of Frank McCourt, is that he brought Frank McCourt, the author of Angela's Ashes and like other Irish memoirs, to speak at our high school because I think the explicit reason was that he thought it was funny that they
shared a name.
And Frank McCourt, the rich guy, introduced Frank McCourt, the author, on stage at our high school just to be like, I thought this would be like a fun little thing. And even we were like kids at the time. We were like, what the fuck is
what
that?
What are you talking about?
What is this? But it was like the best speaker we had in the entire time I was there just because Frank McCourt had the same name as him. But I think it's indicative of Frank McCourt's like real life passion, which is attention.
Himself.
Yes.
So Donald Trump is like the all caps version of Frank McCourt.
Totally.
You know, his wife wanted to run for president.
Jamie?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
she is in
politics.
Very similar.
Now.
Similar pathways.
So he tried to buy the Red Sox. A big part of his plan was to blow up Fenway Park and build a stadium on his parking lot. And that it failed because, again, he is not very rich.
Right. He doesn't have really all the capital it takes to make these dreams
come true. He's totally rich, but he's not anywhere near as rich as he would have to be to make these transactions. But so after that, Frank is like very horned up to own a team. This is not there. In no world does this end without Frank McCourt owning a professional sports franchise. So he tried to buy the Angels. He tried to buy the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And then around this same time, Rupert Murdoch wants to get out of the Dodgers for whatever reason, because he owned the Dodgers before Frank McCourt. Again, another story with so many good guys.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't help but just think, why couldn't they just share?
It tells you that like the universe of ghouls is like so small. It's like 30 people big, and these people just keep showing up over and over
just
again.
Just bumping into each other casually.
Because Rupert Murdoch tried to sell the Dodgers to the Glazers, Malcolm Glazer and Ed Glazer, who owned the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. The Glazers are the people that hosted Trump at that LA fundraiser in Beverly Hills last month.
Last month, yeah.
But that deal fell apart, but the Murdoch wanted to get out of the Dodgers really, really fast. And here's Frank McCourt with an insane offer that is like 75% debt, just like completely fake money. But Murdoch is like, fine, great, just like unloads it to Frank McCourt. So he finally gets his team. McCourt made Jamie McCourt the vice chair of the team, Jamie McCourt, his wife. The president and vice president of the team immediately get some idea of what's going on with Frank McCourt's finances, and they just get the fuck out. And they see the writing on the wall. They say, someone's going to jail at the end of this. we are gone. So they leave. The team goes to shit pretty fast. He has a great first year. I think that first year team was amazing because they had Adrian Beltre, who's like the greatest third baseman of all time. They let him go because it's a contract year for him.
Just can't afford it.
What are they going to do? Pay? This guy's too good. We're going to pay him? I have no money.
Listen, when he's hanging out with the Glazers and the Trumps and the, you know, everybody in that world, he needs to just be able to say he is Dodgers owner Frank McCourt.
Yeah, see, they don't need to be good. What are they? Like, they don't follow sports. They don't care about Adrian Beltre. So let him go. They're not going to pay him $100 million. Then they sort of waffle between being decent and awful for a few years. McCourt raises ticket prices and concession prices every year to try desperately to stay ahead of the debt that he now has to start paying back.
The people threatening to kneecap him at the end of every game.
At the same time, he bought the LA Marathon, which he still owns.
Right.
Started running it from Dodger Stadium, which was a good idea. It's start uphill, so you get momentum, basically, to go all the way to the ocean. Then, the divorce.
Oh, yeah. The most famous divorce in California history.
Jamie McCourt is accused of an affair with her bodyguard / driver. Jamie is represented by David Boies, who represented Harvey Weinstein and ordered Black Cube to follow his victims around.
God,
more good guys.
So much charm.
The good guys pile up. McCourt, who was never super rich to begin with, is now completely broke.
Right.
He had put his Boston parking lot up as collateral When he bought the Dodgers as part of the deal with Fox, he said, right. if for some reason I can't pay this money back, you get my Boston parking lot. He loses it. So Fox Entertainment Group owns...
That's like an heirloom, right?
Yes. It was like, yes, totally. Something he had up for like 30 years. Now Rupert Murdoch owns a parking lot in Boston for no reason. Then he starts borrowing money from Rupert Murdoch, from Fox, to make payroll.
Without
really telling Major League Baseball that he's doing this. So Bud Selig, the commissioner, finds out, takes control of the team, takes it away from Frank McCourt. When the divorce is finalized, the most expensive in California history, Jamie McCourt makes $170 million, uses that money to later become California finance chair of the Trump campaign.
Wow.
Some people might say
they should have made it work. They should have stayed together and made it work.
I think he was maybe holding back some of her career ambitions because he was a Democrat donor.
Right.
I think.
And she wanted to be
She
wanted to be Republican president.
Yes.
But she ended up settling for ambassador.
Yes. She was made ambassador to France by the Trump administration. McCourt finally gets complete control of the team, but is not allowed to go to the stadium because Major League Baseball has taken it away from him. Meanwhile, his Dodgers Dream Foundation is being investigated by the Attorney General of California, who at the time was Jerry Brown.
Oh, damn.
Yep. And he's being investigated because he appointed his friend to run this foundation and paid him $400,000 a year out of assets of $1.6 million total for the foundation. And so Frank McCourt had to personally pay $100,000 in fines to the state because of this while all this is going on. Finally, he agrees to sell the team for $2 billion. He retains ownership of his first love.
The parking lot.
The parking lot of Dodger Stadium.
Oh, man.
And he also gets money. He's not allowed to be involved, but he gets money for any future development of Dodger Stadium.
Okay.
Which brings us to the gondola.
The gondola, baby.
The first
Here we are.
Step in what will definitely eventually be a huge, like...
a thing that exists at some point in the future.
Well, look, here's what's going to happen. I can see, like... They want to do something with all this parking lot space. They don't want to leave it as a parking lot. They want to develop it.
Yeah.
And so if the gondola is like going back and forth, I think they look at... So in Massachusetts, the Patriots turned their stadium into what they call Patriot Place.
Right.
Where there's like a movie theater where you eat dinner in. And like people come and like go shopping there and stuff. I think they want to turn the larger Dodger Stadium complex into like a city walk.
Franktown. I don't know.
Franktown,
I'm
baby.
Sure that you're right, but at the same time, it's like, wow, what a toxic brand. Everything that you just laid out.
Isn't that insane? And to be like, oh, okay, let's have... Well, it's his son. I'm sure the fourth generation of this wealth is the really good one.
The apple does fall far from the tree. You know, like it's...
And look, I'm not... I don't know how you feel about it. I don't mind the idea of this at all. I think it's kind of fun.
I have a really hard time mustering up. This is like, as somebody who follows relentlessly LA transit stories, I have a hard time mustering up like a lot of just passion one way or the other about the Dodger Stadium gondola. What I can say is that you're not replacing all of those cars that drive into Dodger Stadium with a gondola from Union Station to Dodger Stadium. You're just not doing it. It carries 5,000 people an hour.
Yeah.
Which...
what's the capacity of Dodger Stadium? 55,000 or something?
So basically, think about it this way, though. If you have 5,000 people an hour, that means when the game gets out, you have at least 2,500 people waiting... half an hour or more to leave the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know...
Except at Dodger Stadium, where lots of people do leave early already to beat traffic. So they would just do that now to catch the gondola.
To catch the gondola line. You're right. It's 55,000. So
that's a lot. It's not going to take all those cars off the road. The nice thing about it is there's no, like, induced demand, really, with a stadium. It's full or it's not.
It's totally... a harmless idea. It's interesting. At the intro, you were asking whether or not it would be free. I doubt it. It's going
to
be...
Unless they really wanted to get people up there for their like larger development, you know?
That's possible. I imagine they're going to charge for it, especially on game days.
Sure you're right.
And that's kind of a way that you could mitigate the lines too. But yeah, no, as a pure idea, like fine, sure, do it. That sounds great. We have now so many unsolicited private business proposals to do transportation things in the city of LA. And it's really, I think, making it kind of clear that the things that private business owners see as potentially profitable for themselves do not necessarily align with what would make sure. It easier to get around LA.
Can I say, this is maybe not fair to... the Elon Musk tunnel. This project makes a billion times more sense to me. At least the person financially invested in this transit system has like an ulterior motive that is very clear.
So clear.
Which is he wants to get people to his property, which he has a huge stake in.
Right.
It makes me wonder if like we're going to find out eventually that Elon, I don't know, is like buying the Sherman Oaks Galleria or something. That he wants to get people straight from LAX.
I feel
there.
So much more comfortable with this proposal because the ulterior motive is as clear.
It's
as
so
it
transparent.
Is. It makes so
but
much
But with
more
all
sense.
Of these things, I find it very embarrassing as a resident of the city that our elected officials are just so ready to be like, oh, amazing. What a fun idea. Yeah, let's do it. Let's. Well, you can have every exemption you want to,
right.
to do your fun little project.
And it's
the mayor is announcing this thing. You can't get anyone else to to roll this thing out.
Yeah. And he is really on top of pushing a very, I mean, LA is known for being somewhat of, and either idealistic or, I guess, naively optimistic city. But Garcetti is really on top of pushing like a can-do attitude that, I mean, makes a lot of sense if you're trying to say nationally in a time when a lot of people feel not so optimistic about the future. Like, LA is a place where we look towards the future and feel great about it.
Yeah.
Here's a gondola to our baseball stadium.
Yeah. But in all of these cases, it's not so much like, it's kind of like the housing first model that we talked about with Jana and Alexa. They're like, oh, we have this plan to like build housing. We have this plan to change transportation. In every case, it's never the city is going to do it.
No.
It's we are outsourcing this work to whatever, developers or tech billionaires or Frank McCourt. That means that they will let anybody do this.
Yeah, so we have a way to get to the Dodger Stadium already. We have you could walk up from Chinatown. You can take the Dodger Stadium Express
from Union Station. Yeah,
and it has its own little bus lanes on game day that are not well enforced.
No,
let's say.
But it's the only really dedicated bus, the best enforced dedicated bus lane in the city. Probably.
I believe that's true. Which is troubling.
And so the fact that instead of adding more of those around the city, which would be a great idea, they're adding an additional, I don't know.
I love the focus on innovation, though, which is not unique to Garcetti. It's not unique to LA's city council. It's happening a lot in politics, city politics all over. And it's funny because it's just like when... You have these tech companies that are saying, we want to innovate, we want to disrupt existing models. Like, the whole purpose of that is to rethink things that exist and, you know, push forward to the next paradigm or whatever. Like, you can totally not buy into that. But instead, what politicians have done is say, like, innovation, it's what allows us to maintain the political status quo.
Yes.
If we can get... an innovative gondola up to Dodger Stadium, then we don't have to do the political job, our job of like getting people to Dodger Stadium by enforcing these bus lanes or whatever.
Yeah, it feels like they're so thankful for these
it's such
rich
a
people
relief.
Coming in to be like, oh, we'll do it. Oh, thank you so much.
The relief is palpable.
Yeah.
It really is.
We want to do something a little different. We know we like to get serious around here, but we also like to have a little fun and talk about arts and culture and all that kind of fun stuff.
And what is LA? We talk so much about LA.
So, yes, we've talked so much about LA. We've never really figured out the essence of it, but we are going to do that today. We saw that there's a collection on Filmstruck right now. This is not an ad, but it should be. And if they wanted to compensate us after the fact, I don't care.
Native content.
Yes. So they have this series called The Essence of LA, which is like 12 movies from like different eras. Some of them are really great movies. Some of them are like deeper cuts. The biggest one is the most recognizable one is probably Rebel Without a Cause.
Mm-hmm. The Big Sleep was on there.
The Big Sleep, Magnolia, Falling Down, a movie that I absolutely hate. And there were a few movies out there that we hadn't seen. So we each watched two that we would just talk about whether they captured the essence of LA. What was the first one that you watched?
I watched Them. Which is classic old black and white horror movie in which nuclear radiation in the New Mexico desert leads to a swarm of giant ants attacking the population of LA.
Of LA. Yeah. Yes. Them exclamation point.
Them.
Okay.
Yeah, captured that, I thought.
The ants, they eat people?
They do. They eat people. They sting people with, apparently, ants, just black ants have stingers that just inject people with acid.
Oh.
So that was their kind of go-to.
Uh-huh. Does it seem scientifically accurate?
I'm not an ant person. I don't know. It seems to me like maybe they took a little bit of a liberty there.
But you texted me something about this movie that I thought was a very bold observation.
I thought I could tell that it knocked you sideways.
I you could see the dots. Just like trying to figure out
what
to
do
say.
I say to that.
So what was the first observation you made to me about this?
Okay,
movie?
So basically I said this movie from the 50s, early 50s, basically to me as a black person, when I watch it, I see the buildup to the Watts riots in the 60s. And here's where that comes from. It's because you have, from the title on down, a basically an otherization, right?
Yep.
So you have them. Yep. You have then the us of the movie is a very, very white LA. And it's interesting because throughout the movie, the sort of through line is the increasing militarization of the police. It's always the city police that are bringing out like these flamethrowers and tanks, and like it gets pretty ridiculous at a certain point. But you have this like essentially police force that is taking over the city of LA in order to protect a very white population from an invading horde of others. And so to me, I was just like, I'm not saying the ants are rioting, but I am saying that it does seem like there's a sense of dread about impending change as this movie's going on. And it seems to reflect things that were broadly happening in LA from the end of World War II onward.
Is the movie sympathetic to the ants at all?
No,
they hate the ants.
Actually, the very last scene, they're like about to kill the baby queen ant, and the scientist is just like, who knows what's coming next?
And it's not unrelated to the rhetoric that they use now and about like infestation and breeding and all that. And I guess it was probably made at the time when the big migration waves were probably still happening.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sold. Do they show a lot of like cool locations and stuff?
It's mostly desert, and then there's the LA River, and it's actually
what part of the LA River?
You get
you
a
tell?
Great view of the old Sixth Street Bridge. It's like it's almost exactly like the shot in Greece, basically, when they're doing the drag race.
Okay, but cool. Like
30 years earlier,
I watched The Exiles, another movie about a migration to Los Angeles. But this one is about basically the like a group of young Native Americans, like the first generation to have left the reservation. And they all live on Bunker Hill in those old Victorian apartments that were there before they got replaced with like the Aeon building or whatever. And they're just trying to make their way in LA and downtown. And you're like, oh my God, that sounds so boring, but it is really good. First of all, it's an hour long, which is the really perfect length for any movie. And the movie is wild. They're not actors, but they are acting. They are. So the guy that made it was, I think, basically a USC kid, a white kid. But he had made a couple documentaries, and he had met all these people, and he basically had them talk to him, tell their stories, and then reenact their lives in the movie.
Is this a recent movie?
No, sorry. This was like 1961.
Oh, wow.
It's black and white. The whole movie is like pretty clearly dubbed. It looks like a really, really, really good student film. But they're also doing voiceover on the movie as themselves, as you watch them play themselves in the movie. And it's not like the typical glorification of poverty that you see in a lot of these movies, where they're like very dignified and, you know, it's like a noble struggle and all that. These are people that have basically given up and they just want to drink and party and get in fights on Broadway and all that. But it's like, it's made very clear that they're doing this because they have basically no other option.
Just sounds to me like Tangerine. They're just like what you're describing.
Thank you so much for making that comparison, because it really is a lot like Tangerine. That is such a good comparison. There's a main woman in it who's very sad. She's pregnant, but she's ignored by her boyfriend, and she just goes to the movies and she like walks around Broadway, which is crazy because she is her boyfriend is reenacting himself ignoring her in the movie. And like there's another guy in it who just like preys on women in this really gross way and talks about how he does that, but he's then showing himself doing it as like an actor playing himself. It's like this very bizarre thing. The locations are awesome.
Yeah.
It opens in Grand Central Market, where it was a little different. She like goes, it's a Native American woman who goes to Egg Slot. She waits in line for 4 hours and goes to Egg Slot and then gets an $18 uncrustable peanut butter and jelly sandwich. No, it's all like Bunker Hill, Broadway. Broadway is all lit up. It looks so fun.
Yeah.
I saw this movie on Tuesday, Wednesday night, and I was like, I just want to go down there and like just get that feeling of like this place. And so I did. I took the bus down to downtown. I get off around like Bunker, and it's not, obviously I've like been there before, but just like when you're really looking at it at that time, this was like 9 p.m. or something.
Right.
It is completely empty.
Oh, it's so dead.
I walked like 2 or 3 blocks down Broadway without passing anyone who wasn't like asleep. Lots of people who were like asleep on the sidewalk.
Right.
But nobody else, no businesses open.
No.
And back then it was like till 2 a.m. when all the bars closed. And even after that, every place was full.
Right. And there were people
dancing,
on the street.
Yeah. Everyone like going to the movies at all hours. Huge bummer to see it.
I don't know why you did that to yourself.
And I knew it was like in theory that it was going to be like that, but I just wanted to go see all these cool locations, like all the movie theaters and bars and stuff that were in the movie, and it was very depressing. But the movie is great. Talk about the second movie that you saw.
Okay, the second movie I saw, I mean, I felt like it lacked a little bit the poignant sort of bite of them, but so the second movie I watched was Tequila Sunrise, which is not a movie that I knew existed. If you Google it, you will get Tequila Sunrise the drink, and then Tequila Sunrise drink? The Eagles song, and then
what was first?
The drink, actually.
Then the song.
Then the song.
Then the movie.
And then you'll never find the movie. Okay. You have to type Tequila Sunrise movie, or you'll never find it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this is a movie that came out in the late 80s. With Mel Gibson, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Kurt Russell.
I saw it was directed by Robert Town, who wrote
Chinatown,
which someone could suggest is a better selection for a film series about the essence of LA.
What is the essence of LA as communicated by the movie Tequila Sunrise?
Yeah, that's
a good question. I've been thinking about that for the past day and a half since I watched it. And all I can really say is, you know, there are a bunch of good shots of Venice Beach.
Yeah. It's one of those late 80s, early 90s Venice movies.
Right.
So many.
Just a lot of like pondering the plight of somebody who used to smuggle drugs from Tijuana and does not do that anymore. And where
is that Kurt Russell?
That's actually Mel Gibson.
Okay.
Kurt Russell is the cop in this. I'm a sucker for Kurt
Russell.
What a
cast for that time. Are you kidding me?
All of the reviews are kind of just like Robert Town, Mel Gibson, Kurt Russell, what happened with this movie?
Yeah.
But it is, I mean, it's kind of just goofy. It's kind of like somewhere in between Point Break and like Lethal Weapon, basically, what I was reminded of while watching it.
Because
it has, even though it's a cop and robber movie like Point Break, it has a very buddy cop dynamic.
Where,
like,
they are kind of friends.
They're best friends since high school, and then Kurt Russell gets tied.
How did those two find common ground?
Right. And why is Kurt Russell so unconcerned with Mel Gibson smuggling cocaine?
I wonder which of them radicalized the other one on the set of that movie. I'm sure that's when it happened.
That one of them was, I guess, already
a conservative wing nut, and then just brought the other one with him.
How did Michelle Pfeiffer stay above the fray?
Yeah.
I don't know. But anyway, I don't know what this tells me about LA besides that I feel like there are literally a million movies just like this. I have no idea.
I feel like I can watch it in my head without having ever seen it. From how you describe it, I totally know that genre.
Yeah, absolutely.
Movie where everyone was just obsessed with Venice. The other one I saw was White Heat. It barely even takes place in LA. It wasn't like a great selection for the series. It's like the James Cagney gangster movie.
Right.
And there's a very famous, like, in this world, like, scene at the end of it that takes place at an oil refinery in Torrance.
Right.
And there's a big sequence when they're driving to, like a chase scene at the end where they're just shouting out a bunch of like intersections. It basically goes from like Pasadena to the South Bay, and so they'll go like 198th and Western headed southwest. But it mostly takes place in like a jail in Illinois, so it shouldn't have been a part of this series. Oh, but then I watched half of My Brother's Wedding,
right?
The Charles Burnett movie, who did Killer of Sheep, which is great, and it was also very good, but I didn't see the whole thing, so I don't feel.
Does
really
that one have anything more to do with law enforcement? Because I'm getting a sense that, you know, all the other ones kind of do.
Oh yeah. So far, no.
Okay.
So far, there's no LAPD presence, and in the Exiles, there wasn't really either. Although you see at some point that there was a pretty you see the cops beat up a Native American guy at one point. Hard to shoot a movie in the 60s without just like in the background capturing some cops beating up a person of color. So that was our weekly movie review segment that I guess
we're deep into film criticism.
Yeah, never
right
do
now.
Again. We wanted to close by talking about an article that we saw in the LA Times this week by Andrew Corey saying that housing prices in Southern California have reached an all-time high. They finally exceeded 2007,
the peak of the bubble
prices,
basically.
Which means that, but like considering inflation, that they're not worth quite as much now as they were in 2007, which is so unfathomably crazy to me with how expensive property is now, that they could have been the same price when a dollar was worth more.
Yeah.
11 years ago.
Yeah, I mean that it's,
I guess that's
there hasn't been a ton of
exploded
inflation since
sure
then, but yes, it is pretty ridiculous just the notion that we had this bubble that was so severe that you got prices that it would take us another what is that, 11 years now to get back to?
To get back to and to still not be, yeah, worth quite as much. And so this is in all six counties of Southern California. Can you name them?
All six counties?
Yeah, sorry to be quizzing you.
This that's good. Ventura,
yeah,
LA, San Bernardino, Riverside.
Oh, you're going north to south, basically.
Orange County.
Yeah.
And Imperial?
No.
San Diego.
San Diego County.
See, San Diego's not in Skag, so.
Okay. That was not my thought process. I tried to figure it out. Los Angeles was one that hit a record high. They didn't all hit record highs. They did overall, but LA County did hit a record high with a median price of $585,000. That it went up 6.6% total from last year, which I don't think is as high a jump as it has had in previous. Haven't there been like 8 or 9% jumps in?
Yeah, it's a little
bit. Years preceding that.
It's a little bit tempered.
So it is slowing down a little bit, but still, that is a huge leap, especially when it is so expensive. Okay, so you're like seller's market,
right?
Great, you know, great time to.
It's always a seller's market.
Sure. Yet.
Sometimes
this article says there were fewer homes for sale in all six counties in Southern California than there were this is this past March than there were in March of last year, which would definitely suggest that a shortage of housing supply has something to do. If prices are going up, 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 and yet fewer and fewer houses are going on sale, then there is a shortage of.
Absolutely.
Housing on the market.
You also have this phenomenon in California of homeowners essentially being house rich.
Yeah.
But the likelihood of them being able, if they did sell their house for however much money, to be able to afford somewhere comparable to where they're living is almost zero.
To be able to move within Southern California.
Or even in California at all. And that's why we see such a large number of people at retirement age sell, cash out of the enormous accrued value in their houses, and then move to Las Vegas or Phoenix or wherever
it is. Yeah. So we need more housing stock in order to bring prices down. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a debate to be had over whether market rate development or subsidized development is like what proportion of those is the best solution to bring prices down. That's not a debate that we should have on this show. I feel like even by bringing it up, like a DSA person and a YIMBY are gonna like explode through the wall. Like just this conversation happening anywhere.
Punches will be thrown.
Yeah.
Virtually, of course.
We are about to run out of space on our SD card. So that is it for the show for this week. We will be back next week. We never explain why we didn't have a guest next week. Sometimes we will, sometimes we won't. And next week, I think we probably will.
We think so.
Bye.